Wow, this is really high. I'm delighted to be back in this beautiful city. I remember being here for GA, and it's wonderful to be in this very beautiful congregation. How many of you know or knew before you came here this morning that we had an office at the United Nations? Yeah, that's about what I expected. That's why I make these visits. Anybody know how long you've had an office at the United Nations? 57 years. News travels slowly, I guess. In that time, I want to highlight three different areas, and then I want to get into the body of my sermon. But in the 1970s, our office, together with a rabbi and Ritsuko Sekai, which is a Japanese Buddhist organization, started Religions for Peace, which is a paramount interreligious interfaith organization working for peace. In the 1990s, the UUUNO led the faith-based caucus, and John Washburn and Elaine Harvey went to Rome, helped negotiate the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court, which makes sure that human rights violations cannot be committed with impunity, that there will be a cost. And finally, in my tenure, which started in 2008, we have implanted LGBT rights into the United Nations as they've never been implanted before. They're firmly part of every bit of what the United Nations does, 108 agencies of the United Nations, all their policies, procedures, and programs. There now is an LGBT component to that. We have a tradition. We have a seminar every April. Our coming seminar in 2020 will be on climate change. It's going to be the second week in April. You're invited. Please come. Send your youth. It's intergenerational. The seminar we had this year in 2019 was on gender equity. And so our sermon for that year, for this year, is on the topic of our seminar, the last seminar, which is gender equity. I want to begin my talk with perhaps the best book I've ever read. I know that's a big thing to say, but it's really an amazing book. And it's called How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi. It's been written up in the Washington Post just recently, New York Times. It's really great. I don't want to give too much away. The author is deeply discusses bigotry based on race, gender, and all other forms of racism and bigotry. He begins his discussion of gender with the wedding of his parents. He's a young guy, you'll see that in a second. It was early August 1976, the Tuesday before the Saturday my parents were scheduled to wed. Running down the ceremony, Pastor Winfred Kimby recited the Christian wedding vows to my parents. Here it goes. Husbands, love your wives, and wives, obey your husbands. And his mother said, I'm not obeying him. And the pastor said, what? He said in shock, turning to look at my father. And what? The father said as well, turning to look at my mother. And she said, the only man I obeyed was my father when I was a child. She nearly shouted, staring into my dad's wide eyes. You're not my father and I'm not a child. Ibrahim's dad proposed, what about, are you willing to submit to one another? My mother agreed. She had been rethinking Christian sexism, and she rejected the patriarchal ideals. And again, I'm quoting Kendi's book, Black queer activists, too, have been marginalized after they launched the gay liberation movement. Francis Beale audaciously proclaimed in his 1968 book, Black women in America are justly described as a slave of a slave, the victim of double jeopardy of racism and sexism. Intersectional black identities are subjected to what Crenshaw described as the intersection of racism and other forms of bigotry, such as ethnocentrism, colorism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia. Kendi writes, my journey, and it's one of the things I like about his book, he talks about his own journey to become an anti-racist. My journey to being an anti-racist first recognized the intersectionality of my ethnic racism, then my bodily racism, then my cultural racism, then my color racism, then my class racism, and when I entered graduate school, my gender racism and queer racism. I want you to read this book, and I don't have the time to read it to you here. I hope I've established that sexism and racism exist and that they're both wrong and need to be defeated. We need to know that in this country and in many others, women and the feminine in general are relegated to inferior status, inferior pay, and responsibility in all aspects of life. We pay a heavy price for that marginalization. All of us suffer, no matter what our gender, because when any of us is excluded or marginalized, we all suffer. Together with people of color, women and the feminine are everywhere subjected to violence. When I refer to women and the feminine, I mean, for example, feminine gay men are subjected to more violence than masculine gay men. Whenever the feminine appears, there's irrational violence. Violence against women is increasing in the United States and around the world. The FBI has reported a nearly 20% increase in rape in the United States. I want to spend the rest of my time talking about six remarkable women that I have met and really have changed my life. I'm going to begin with Mother Teresa of Calcutta. I was posted to the American Consul General in Calcutta, and my mother sent me $20 to give to Mother Teresa. I figured 20 wasn't enough, so I put another $20, it's a whole $40, and I put it in an envelope with a very nice note, and I gave it with one of the consul drivers to send to Mother Teresa. And when I got home that evening, my phone was ringing, so I jiggled the lock, and I opened the door, and I grabbed the phone, and it's Mother Teresa. Not somebody calling on her behalf, it's Mother Teresa herself. And she said, "That was a very nice letter you wrote. Can I meet you?" She asked me if she can meet me. I said, "Sure." And she said, "Can you be at the mother house at 10 o'clock tomorrow?" And I said, "Yes." So I went down there and I spent a full hour with her holding my hand. I said, "This living saint is holding my hand." And she did have an agenda. She said, of course she has an agenda. She always had an agenda. The U.S. government was charging $100 for a 5-year multiple entry visa to go from India to the United States. And she was sending her nuns to the U.S. to take care of dying AIDS patients that the U.S. government is not taking care of. She did it, you know, she's sticking it to me, you know. So we're taking care of Americans who your government are not taking care of, and they shouldn't be charged $100. People like your mother don't give that money so we can give it to the U.S. government for a visa. This money needs to help the people that it's supposed to help. So I said, "I'll do what I can. Is there anything else I can do for you?" And I expected her to say, "Well, write me a check." But she said, "No, do some volunteer work in my home for the dying." And I was like, "Oh, that's the last thing I want to do." But because Mother Teresa asked me to do it, I did it, and it was a very rewarding experience. That's how she got her start. She didn't want people dying in the streets of Calcutta. So I went back to the consul and I talked to Catherine Burke, who was the visa officer, and I said, "We need to give free visas to Mother Teresa's nuns so they can take care of dying AIDS patients." And she said, "Let Elizabeth Taylor take care of the dying AIDS patients." I said, "Okay." So a couple of weeks go by, and my secretary came into my office, and she said, "Bruce, you have a visitor downstairs." And I said, "Who the hell is it now?" And she said, "It's Mother Teresa." And I said, "Oh my God." So I brought Mother Teresa up to my office and sat her on the couch. I had a couch in my office in those days. That was really cool. So sat her on the couch and I called Catherine Burke and I said, "Catherine, remember what you were saying about Elizabeth Taylor and all that? Well, Mother Teresa's in my office right now. Why don't you come up and tell her yourself?" So Catherine Burke came up and Mother Teresa, within seconds, had her converted too. And so both of us went to Ron Lorton, the Consul General, and she started getting free visas. And the work that she did, Mother Teresa did, starting with pennies from a few people building a global organization which has changed the world. So I'll move on, because I don't have much time. Sister Joan Kirby. Sister Joan Kirby was a Catholic nun and a Buddhist nun, both at the same time. And she was one of the first people I met at the United Nations. Very experienced, very knowledgeable of the UN. And she gave me the nun look. This is the nun look. And I think she saw me as this upstart, pushy person trying to push LGBT rights at the United Nations. And I was scared of her because she gave me the nun look, you know. But after a while, very quickly, she flipped and she decided to help me. And she became my mentor. And we were organizing the Human Rights Conference in Paris to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Human Rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I wanted to get LGBT rights on the agenda of that conference, and she helped me do it. She talked to Shimita Gonzaga, who was the conference chair, the youngest conference chair ever, and she said, what about Bruce's LGBT rights? So that they were my rights. And anyway, and she was my mentor. She was wonderful. We had a seminar on empowering women for a better world, and I asked Sister Joan, I said, would you please speak at our seminar on empowering women for a better world? She said, only if I can talk about being a woman in a patriarchal church. I said, yeah, Sister Joan, you go for it. So she was at the seminar. The New York had just installed, I think, a new archbishop. And she started her talk by, and she did this with her hands. And she said, did you see that on TV, installing the new archbishop? All men, nothing but men, like that, she said. And you know, she talked about how frustrating it was to be a very knowledgeable, capable woman in the Catholic Church and yet not having any authority, not having any decent responsibility. And then she talked about her life as a Buddhist nun, and she said pretty much ditto, the same thing for Buddhist nuns. Buddhist nuns are always relegated to a second-class status under Buddhist monks. So I gotta move on, time's flying here. Queen Mother Esther of Ghana. We have a project in Ghana called the Every Child is Our Child Project. And we did something different. We went into this community in Ghana that had the highest HIV infection rate in the country, a lot of AIDS orphans. And the Queen Mothers, these are the royal women of this community, the Maya Krobo people. Ghana and some other African countries kind of have two levels of government. They have the Western-style democracy with a parliament and a president, which is all based on kind of British-American ideals. But underneath that, they've kept the ideas of the status of chiefs and queen mothers, so royal men and women who help the society and govern it in some ways. And so the queen mothers were in charge of basically helping AIDS orphans. And Manya Esther, Queen Mother Esther, told me, she said, you know, We are taking care of these children. They're in our homes. It's not an orphanage. We're taking care of these children in our homes or extended families. But we're poor people, and we have to send our own children to school, and now we have to send orphan children to school. And if you could take care of school fees and uniforms, which is the British system, you got to have a full uniform to go to school, and books and book bags and those kinds of incidental expenses. And oh, by the way, Ghana, unlike the United States, has a national healthcare system. But to access the national healthcare system, you have to have a healthcare card. You've got to get renewed every year, and it costs a couple of bucks, about $5. But orphan kids don't have $5. So what we decided to do is we need to pay for that as well. And because the caregiving family, some of the members of the family didn't have healthcare cards, we said we will give a healthcare card to everybody in the family that's taking care of one of the orphan children that we're sponsoring. And Mommy Esther was just fabulous. And she said, you know, it's not that you're just giving us money, that we're in a relationship together. And I've spent a lot of time in Africa, and it's one of the things I love about Africa. It's not so true of the United States. Africans are very relational people. They relate, they talk, they're all about families and relationships and friendships. And Manya Esther, Queen Mother Esther, actually was teaching us to be more relational. So I learned a lot from her. Next one. Pauline Park. Pauline Park is a trans woman. She's a member of All Souls Church in New York. And she went to the bathroom in Manhattan Mall next to Penn Station, and she was arrested for using the woman's bathroom. And if you look at her, she's a woman. What other bathroom would she use? But she was arrested. She took New York City to court, and she won the case. And she has been a trans activist in New York City. She's absolutely fabulous, one of the smartest people I know. She's actually from Korea originally, so she's also an advocate for refugee rights and immigrant rights. And she's also an advocate for another group of rights that we don't pay too much attention to because we've got a problem in that area. She's a big advocate for Palestinian rights, and that's an area that we kind of have difficulty with. Next person, Leslie Udwin. Leslie Udwin is a documentary filmmaker, and she made India's Daughter, which is a documentary film about this medical student in India who was raped. So the story was, this Indian woman had come from a very poor family. She went through medical school, a lot of hardship getting through. She got her medical degree. She was about ready to become a community health doctor. She asked her boyfriend, she said, I want to celebrate getting my doctorate. Let's go to a movie. So they went out to a movie, and after the movie there was a bus, and they asked the bus driver, are you going to our neighborhood? And the bus driver said yes, so they both got on the bus, and she was raped to death. The boyfriend was killed, boyfriend was beaten up, and she didn't die immediately. She went to the hospital, and for days the surgeons tried to put her back together again and failed. So she died in tremendous pain and suffering. And here was this bright young woman ready to start her life as a medical doctor, and she was raped. And what Leslie Udwin did is the rapists were caught and convicted to death. And Leslie talked to the rapists and their lawyers. And what she found out was that the rapists and lawyers had no remorse. There was no guilt. They said she was a bad girl, she was out after dark without her parents, she deserved what she got and made an example for the community. That was their story. And Leslie said they were programmed that way. They didn't have any sense of what they were doing. And so she started a curriculum. She's given up documentary filmmaking, and she's devoted her entire life to this curriculum called Think Equal. And it starts at the age of 3. To teach children to think equal. Men and women are equal. Black and white are equal. Gay, straight, equal. We're all equal. And it's a resounding success. The first country to adopt it as part of the national curriculum was Sri Lanka. Botswana and Kenya are using it. Many schools in Canada are using it. And it's amazing. She and her husband, and me and my husband, went to Hanoi, Vietnam, and proposed it to the Vietnamese, and they have also decided that they want this as part of their curriculum as well. So my last woman that I want to talk about is Master Chen Yen. She is the founder of the Buddhist Compassionate Relief Tsuchi Foundation. She reminds me so much of Mother Teresa. She started off 57 years ago with pennies from housewives to help poor people. And what she found as she was helping the poor, that one of the greatest causes of poverty was health issues. And people get sick, they get injured, they can't pay their medical bills, they fall into poverty, they can't work, and they can't get out. And we see that here in the United States, because we don't have a good national health care system. People get sick or they get injured and they get poor and they can't get out. So she decided to build a hospital in Hualien, Taiwan, which is a very rural area. It's not near Taipei. It's a poor area of the country. And she got big donors, obviously. She started with pennies, but she wound up with bigger money than that. And then she had this great hospital, and the doctors didn't want to go there because it was a rural area. So then she built a medical school so she could get herself some doctors and nurses. Now she has 7 hospitals in Taiwan, more in Malaysia, more in Indonesia. And what I love about her, there's an earthquake in Ecuador. She's in 100 countries around the world, 57 countries she has offices in. She has 10 million volunteers around the world. Started off with pennies, and now 10 million volunteers. And she's a Buddhist nun, sort of second-class citizen within the Buddhist hierarchy. But this is what she's been able to do, despite the odds against her. And so in Ecuador, there was an earthquake, and the community's church, Catholic church, was destroyed. And Master Cheng Yan said that church was important to this community. So they rebuilt the church, they got the bishop to reconsecrate it, and I just love the image of Buddhists building a Catholic church. They've also built mosques in Indonesia, so I love that concept of that. And I'm gonna race through the rest, and if you wanna hear more, then come after the service and we'll talk some more, I'll take questions. But each of these women went far beyond all expectations of what they could do. And the more we allow women to share in leadership and governance, the better it is for all of us. Sexual orientation and gender identity, human rights are in danger in several places around the world. I have particular concerns in Hungary, where we have a lot of Unitarians, and Romania, and Poland, and they are EU members where we expect better respect for human rights. Russia is really the arch enemy of human rights, especially in its Republic of Chechnya. And there, one of the things we've been able to do with the United Nations is get an independent expert on sexual orientation and gender identity. And usually when these independent experts' term expires, it's renewed by consensus. Everybody votes, yeah, let the guy have another term. Not this case. Because it's sexual orientation, gender identity. There was stiff opposition from Russia and many other countries. He did get his term extended by a margin of one vote. So that's where we are on that. And we were seeing authoritarian ethno-nationalistic governments in Brazil, in India, Philippines, Turkey, other parts of the world. The United States has long been an important defender of human rights internationally. Now it is completely missing in action. It's not active at the United Nations, it's just missing. The American government seems only interested in money and winning the next election at all costs. I ask for you to help us continue our work at the United Nations. The collection today will be for our office. There are also donor envelopes like this around. We'd like you to become a continuing donor. So if you fill out the form and give us any kind of donation, or even if you don't give us a donation, if we have your address, we can send you materials on what we're doing and what the United Nations is doing. And if you don't like it, you can opt out and we'll stop sending you emails. But if you really want to know how the Unitarian Universalists are active at the United Nations, please donate and support our work and be part of what we do, and we want to be part of what you do and work together. Thank you very much.